Thank you. I'm very pleased to be here, and I want to thank you all for the work that you do. It's very similar to the work that I have done in the second half of my career after I left Calvin College. I did that largely to work with graduate students, and that's been my primary vocation, Christian higher education at the graduate level. So I'm very happy to speak to a group like this that we're all colleagues in this. And what I have to say, I have some fears that you all know more about this topic than I do, because you're looking at it on the ground and I'm looking at it sort of from the air and with historical perspective. So I'm hoping that what I can do is to generate a conversation, begin a conversation, raise some points. Some will be familiar. I hope some will suggest new ways of thinking about things. And you have the outlines there. You'll see the several parts that are not as perfectly related to each other. They're related in my mind, but I think the outline is helpful to discrete parts that are interrelated with each other. The main topic for conversation is how things are, what the trajectory are we on as far as the place of Christianity in American higher education. And I think about that particularly since I wrote the book, The Soul of the American University, which came out in 1994. So I was working on that 20 years ago in 1991. That's when I was actually had a leave. I was at Berkeley working on this book. And so the question is, in my mind, how have things changed since the time I was working on that book? And that's something I think most of you know about. Many of you look as though you may have been in this business for the past 20 years. So you may know something on the topic. And then Steve suggests the question, which is a very good question: what would success look like, or what would better look like? And I leave that as a question for discussion. I think in order to get the historical perspective on what's happened in the last 20 years, it's helpful to go back maybe 40 years. Because then you get a real contrast with the way things look today. 40 years ago, most scholars still looked at the place of religion in Western civilization in the context of the secularization thesis. And basically, the assumption of the secularization thesis was that as modernity advanced, religion, particularly traditional religion, would recede to the margins. And the United States was regarded as a little bit backward in that regard, because there were regions in the United States, particularly the South, where religion hadn't receded all that much, and also immigrant communities, and also fundamentalist churches and their successors, and new Pentecostal churches and the like, had not quite caught up with modernity. But the assumption pretty much was that that things would go in that direction. And that prediction, of course, has come true in large parts of Europe and Great Britain. We spent a few years ago a semester at St. Andrews in Scotland, and attending the Presbyterian Church there, maybe 50 people in the church. I was in my mid-60s at the time. I was about the median age of people in the congregation. They had a children's service. The only children were the children of the pastor. Christianity's sort of dying on the vine there in one of the places where it was strongest. But that hasn't really happened in the United States. But people 40 years ago were predicting that it would happen. I just went back for another purpose to an article written by one of the leading church historians of the 1960s, William McLaughlin, who taught at Brown University, has an essay in Daedalus called Is There a Third Force in Christendom? And third would be there's Protestant, mainline Protestants, there's Catholics, and then some people are talking about here's these evangelicals. Are they some new force that's going to be a factor in American life? And basically, he said, no, they're essentially fringe sects. And he said, this is a quotation, these do not appear to have a potential to be a major new cultural force, but rather appear to be the usual and inevitable emotional and institutional effluvia of a major alteration within Christendom. So he's writing in the 60s thinking, well, there's a new age coming, and this is kind of the spin-off on the margins. So we can see from that perspective, things have picked up a lot for evangelicals. And evangelicals have flourished in the past 40 years, not only in the cultural more isolated sorts of areas or backwaters, but also in urban centers, suburban centers, high-tech centers, and often evangelicals have flourished in places where people are becoming highly educated, and many more evangelicals are going into higher education, attending colleges and universities than they did 40 years ago. So the community is not only flourishing, but it's also beginning to flourish in education. And 20 years ago, when I was working on the soul of the American University, that educational flourishing wasn't nearly as obvious as I think it is today. At the same time I was writing The Soul of the American University, Mark Knoll wrote a short book, which is a better book because it was short, called reminds me, I wrote a big biography of Jonathan Edwards, 500 pages, then I wrote a 150-page short biography. One of my friends wrote to me and said, George, you should have told me you're going to write a short biography. I wasted all this time. Anyway, Mark wrote this, The Scandal of the Evangelical Mind, and basically saying the scandal of the evangelical mind is that evangelicals don't have a mind. And I'm not sure Mark would say that anymore. At least there are all sorts of evidences that although there's plenty of anti-intellectualism to go around still in evangelicalism, as you all are well aware, there's also a part of evangelicalism that's very serious about their thinking, and I think the seriousness with which evangelicals take their view of reality, that things really matter, and so evangelicals emerge in university settings sometimes as people who are really concerned about issues that other people are concerned. I remind probably some of you have participated in or know about the roundtable discussions at Harvard and at Amherst. And What they do is they—I don't know where they get the money—but they find a sponsor who provides funding to have a very nice dinner for selected invited faculty, about half of whom are Christian and half of whom are not Christian, from Harvard and MIT, is the ones that I've participated in. And then they have this very nice dinner, and people just—they talk at the tables and so forth. They have very brief presentations. I did one where I spoke on the role of Christianity at the university, and then a Harvard professor of biology spoke about how his job in life is to disabuse young Christians of their religious sorts of view. And we gave these very these presentations, I guess we did before they ate, then people talked about them at their tables, and then the speakers didn't speak, but people went around the table and voluntarily spoke on this topic. And the non-Christian people said the non-Christians came to that because there's very few interdisciplinary venues that people have where people will talk about these sorts of issues. Well, in any case, there's a lot of evidence, as you are all aware working with graduate students, that a lot of graduate programs have been flooded with very dedicated evangelical scholars. And Notre Dame, it's true in history, people, Mark Knowles now at Notre Dame, and we've been getting maybe 40, 50 applicants for two positions in to work in American religious history. That's certainly true in philosophy at Notre Dame. Al Plantinga had the same thing. I'm sure Christian Smith gets at least that many. There's just lines of really excellent people going into these programs, as you're aware. And the result is there's this something of a renaissance, I think, in Christian academia. You can see one evidence of it is in Christian colleges and universities. The CCCU schools are one of the fastest growing, or I think the fastest growing segment of higher education in the past 20 years. And one of the reasons for that is those schools can assemble excellent faculties in the buyer's market and that really compete with with the best schools in the country. And the same thing is true, as again you're aware, Michael Lindsay talks about faith in the halls of power, that there are quite a few younger evangelical scholars who are taking their positions at major universities, and that's bound to be some kind of a leaven in these universities. And the question is, and I guess the question that you've been all working on and thinking about is, how might that contingent of scholars change the face of higher education? There was a book 20 years ago maybe called Tenured Radicals, and talking about how the people from the 60s were reshaping education back in the 90s. Will there be a tenured evangelicals book that this has shaped, has reshaped things? So that's the question I want to address. And I think part of the opportunity is related to the example of the roundtable discussions that I mentioned, that there are a lot of people in higher education who are secularists but who are discontent with the quality of secular higher education. There seem to be a spate of books on that topic right now, which you're probably aware of. I just read Anthony Kroneman's Education's End, why our colleges and universities have given up on the meaning of life. And it's a very thoughtful discussion of why we need better secular humanism. Sort of the secular humanism of the mid-20th century would be good for the university because it talks about the meaning of life. Or I like the book by former Dean at Harvard, Harry Lewis. You probably know the book, Excellence Without a Soul, How a Great University Forgot Education. And Lewis is another of these older scholars who remembers the day when Harvard taught the best in the West, and the idea was to build, as he puts it, and transform teenagers into adults with learning and wisdom to take responsibility for their own lives. And now he thinks, as an academic dean, that simply doesn't happen at Harvard, or it isn't something at Harvard. It may happen at Harvard, but it isn't something that, that Harvard really makes happen or has any program to see as it would happen. So he sees Harvard University as having lost its soul. And as a dean, he sees the reason for that is that we live in a consumer society, and each interest group is used to getting what they want. And they everybody, the parents and the children and the alumni and the donors and the funding agencies all come in with their own agendas. And faculty members are not really interested particularly in teaching so much as they're interested in advancing their career, that they're in a competitive kind of setting. And so there's no rhyme or reason in the course offerings. Course offerings are related to faculty specialties, and that reflects a kind of consumerist attitude that in a competitive society, each person is working for themselves, but there's no overall pattern that's guiding everything. And so there's a kind of hollowness in even the best of higher education. And if that's true at Harvard, how much more is it true at schools that have a much higher percentage of things that are going on that are simply technical education, which is the largest part of higher education. In any case, people who study the humanities, the percentage who study the humanities is somewhere in the single digits. So, if we're asking the question, okay, we're having evangelicals, excellently trained evangelicals are taking their places on faculties. The problem that we still face, though, is that universities are overwhelmingly shaped by the economic interests of a consumerist society. And so people are really being prepared for lifestyle choices. In that respect, higher education is not a lot different ideologically from mainstream media or entertainment, where basically what you're learning is to be in control of your own destiny. And so that's a problem that we face, and it's partly a problem that tends to drive the humanities out, and therefore the questions from what's the meaning of life kind of question is more difficult to address in the mainstream universities. So if you ask a question, well, where does then evangelical Christianity fit in that setting? It's pretty clear there's not an easy answer to that. We can't reclaim the major universities. Duke University may have once been a Methodist school, and it still does have a decent divinity school, but it's not a Christian it's not a Christian university. And Ohio State, even though it has a comparable basketball team, is even less likely is even less likely to. We'll talk about it. We'll have a provost here tomorrow. That you have huge economic interests and huge questions of justice and pluralism and so forth that just make it unthinkable that Christians could somehow reclaim these universities. And I mention that because the most puzzling misunderstanding of the work I did on the soul of the American university is that quite a few scholars insisted that what I was saying was a Christian should take over these universities, that Harvard was once a Christian university, we should take Harvard back. And I say, many times, that's not what I mean, and I explain, which I'll explain in a minute, why it's sort of the opposite of what I mean. But nonetheless, that's what people perceive. And my experience in talking about these sorts of subjects is that what people perceive, what we think we're saying and what people are hearing are two different things. I've noticed that I noticed that in when it was at Duke, actually. When I said evangelical, what people heard was fundamentalist. And no matter how well I explained that, there were people who just insisted on responding to what I said as fundamentalist. And by fundamentalist, they mean someone who's going to take over the university with a right-wing political agenda. So that's part of the problem, that people perceive evangelicals as inherently establishmentarian, that there's an agenda to take back America. And it's related to the whole idea of America with Christian origins. What our job is to bring it back to that. And it's a very strong ideology within the evangelical community, and it's sort of the stereotype that people, the lens that people see us through. So I think it's very important to have a way of explaining that's not what we're about. And That relates to the question of what would count for success in a pluralistic setting. And if taking over the university is not what we're counting as success, how do we explain what it is? And on that, I find the principles that have developed in the tradition of Abraham Kuyper to be very helpful. And I see there's some books on Kuyper in the on the bookshelves here at the bookstore. And I'm sure you're familiar with a good bit of his work. But I think in this context, one of the things that's important about Kuyper is that whereas American evangelical Protestants lived in a tradition where there was a kind of de facto Protestant establishment in the 19th century. And a lot of evangelicals today still have a sense they should go back to that. In Kuyper's world, there's much more of a sense of a principled pluralism that Christians don't just see things the way other people do, that everything in their vision is shaped by their basic principles, by their Christian principles. And you're all familiar with the whole idea of faith and learning, integration of faith and learning growing out of that sensibility that, on the one hand, Christians need to engage the highest learning, But on the other hand, in engaging it, you're always doing it with a critical edge, that you're trying to be both the best sort of science, you do the best science in your discipline, but also you're doing it from a different perspective. Well, that principle of that idea of pluralism relates to how Christianity ought to relate to the de facto public institutions of society, and universities, even privately owned universities, are de facto public institutions. And I think the goal that we want to articulate is the goal that basically says that there ought to be an equitable pluralism that includes religious perspectives on equal grounds with non-religious perspectives. And the problem historically with American Protestantism is that it's had this establishmentarian kind of instinct. And at first, the idea was we'll have public universities, but they're essentially Protestant in the 19th century. In the 20th century, that becomes impractical, and they shift to, well, we have public universities, but they'll be essentially a kind of general morality. But by the second half of the 20th century, the establishmentarian kind of mentality is an establishmentarianism of secularism, that the only way to get equality in the university, people think, is to have a pure secularism. You treat all religions equally by practically keeping them out of the intellectual life of the university. Whereas the ideal from the Kuyperian tradition and from the Dutch heritage is not that one religious group ideally ought to be dominating the public institutions, but rather should be developing a kind of pluralism that would insist on treating all groups on an equal basis and including religious groups within the standards of pluralism. Well, in making that point, I come to the third point on my outline is related to the second in this way, that today I think there is good reason to think that the monopoly of naturalism in the university is beginning to weaken, and particularly the monopoly of ideological naturalism or worldview naturalism. And here what I want to do is remind you of the distinction, which is a distinction that we all deal with, but don't always think about exactly, a distinction between naturalism as a methodology and naturalism as an ideology. We live in a very secularized world in the sense that most of the time we deal with things on purely naturalistic kinds of principles. Even Christians deal with things on purely naturalistic principles. So it may help to pray, but if I want to figure out how my new cell phone works, I have to, find some other. I have to make a phone call I have to find some other way to find out how the technology works, or if the pilot is landing at O'Hare in a storm, it's fine if he or she is praying, but on the other hand, you don't want them to come on the intercom and say, "Don't worry, folks, we're just going to follow the leading of the Lord. We don't need the we don't need the instrument." We're all naturalists in that sense. And that kind of naturalism works very well in higher education. Most of the disciplines just work best on naturalistic principles. And also that kind of methodological naturalism works very well in a pluralistic setting. It's much easier in a pluralistic setting to get everyone to agree, well, we'll simply deal with the technical issues. And everyone of every ideology can talk about these technical issues and work together harmoniously on these issues. So there's all sorts of practical reasons for the dominance of naturalism in the university. But all those practical reasons for favoring methodological naturalism opened the door in the 20th century for people who asserted what I'm calling worldview naturalism or ideological naturalism, that said that naturalism is not only the best method to use, but it's also the highest intellectual way of dealing with things, and that other kinds of ways of looking at things, non-naturalistic ways, including religious ways of looking at things, are inferior ways of looking at things, and for ideological reasons should therefore be excluded from the universities. I think that ideological naturalism is beginning to weaken as an outlook, and I think it has in the past. I think it's weaker today than it was 20 years ago. And one of the reasons for the weakening is that ideological naturalism came in two different forms. One is what you might call scientifically based naturalism, the old style that led to logical positivism in philosophy and the like, saying the highest ways of getting the truth have to be based on strict evidence or logical conclusions. But the other kind of naturalism that became more prominent in the later decades of the 20th century would be the sort of naturalism that's sometimes called constructionism, related to postmodernism, that basically says all our beliefs are constructed, and that that second kind version of ideological naturalism undermines the first, and so that what one finds in the latter part of the 20th century is less and less confidence in saying that any point of view should be definitive, and therefore less and less confidence to say only naturalistic viewpoints themselves should be accepted. And it seems to me, without becoming postmodernists ourselves, that opens the door for saying that religious beliefs ought to be treated equally, that we should have a pluralism in society, but the pluralism should be one that includes the whole range of religious beliefs along with non-religious ideologies. And I think there's some evidence that even in the secular community, people are becoming suspicious of naturalism as an ideology. I think we've had this spate of books that are by Dennett and Christopher Hitchens and Dawkins, Terry Eagleton calls them Ditchkins, he describes them as a kind of the equivalent of religious fundamentalists in the scientific community. Or here's a quote from the New York Times of a few years ago, reviewing this is by Leon Wieslitter, literary editor of the New Republic, writes about one of the books. He says, "Scientism, the view that science can explain all human conditions and expressions, mental as well as physical, is a superstition, one of the dominant superstitions of our day, and it is not an insult to science to say so." So he's making the distinction between science and scientism. "For a sorry instance of present-day scientism, it would be hard to improve on Daniel C. Dennett's book. Well, that's coming from the New York Times. So I think that there's evidence that the monopoly of naturalism in the academy is weakening, or at least it's easier to make the case that pluralism should include views that go beyond naturalism. So for that reason, that's one of the reasons why I think things have improved in the last 20 years. I'll mention just two other factors that seem to me to be significant. One is the events since 9/11 are important to what's happened, because since the fall of the Soviet Union and then those events have made it obvious to everyone that religion is here to stay and religious viewpoints have to be learned about. And to some extent, it also makes the point that they have to be taken seriously, that people that they're not just epiphenomenal, but they're central to a lot of people. And I think that that's helpful for saying we need, if we're going to understand the varieties of people in the world, again, have a true pluralism, then we need to take religious views seriously, and not only as simply an object of study, but also as something that people are serious about. And that is another positive factor that can open the door for Christian perspectives in the mainstream academy. On the other side is the continuing factor of the culture wars, and the religious right, I think, constantly counters that other factor with simply the prejudice against Christianity as being essentially fundamentalist or essentially right-wing that I mentioned before. So there are still are some major obstacles to be overcome, but it seems to me that on the whole, there are factors to be very encouraged in the past 20 years. The number of younger scholars taking their place in the academy seems to be a very encouraging factor. The recognition of the hollowness of mainstream higher education is an encouraging factor, and the weakening of ideological naturalism, worldview naturalism, seems to me to be an encouraging factor. And all those things are factors that really, I think, have moved in the right direction in the last 20 years. So my question to you is that right? Are we better off with respect to the place of Christianity in the academy today than we were 20 years ago? So I'd be very interested in your take on that. Thank you. Yeah. Again, you probably know more about that than I do. Though that's my reason for going into graduate education is to train people like that. But even the people I've trained, there are some that are trained who are very reluctant to speak out. I'd say most are willing, you know, are willing to. But I do see that as particularly people who study in an essentially secular graduate program. Basically, what you learn in a graduate program is to keep your private beliefs to yourself, and that it's unprofessional to insert them into your academic work. And it's very hard for people to get over that, and they're likely to transmit that view to their own students, and also. So the essential category I think is privatization that you mentioned, that because universities are regarded as public institutions, the standard way of dealing with religion in public institutions is to say it's fine to be religious, that's great, but it's a private. It's essentially a private matter, and that's sort of the professional attitude. So that's where there needs to be a lot of education. I'm not sure how you. I think what you people can do best is provide communities where graduate students say to each other, these things are really important, and why shouldn't we speak out? And the more people who do, and do it well, the easier it is for other people to do it. And that's partly why I'm encouraged, is that my experience is that if in the mainstream academy, you simply do your homework well, you can speak from a Christian perspective explicitly, and people will respect that. But there's a lot of people who just don't believe that they're afraid of that, or they haven't really been. I mean, part of the problem is they have a PhD in sociology, and they have a kind of Sunday school learning of Christianity. Well, the two are unequally yoked, and of course they can't really relate the two very 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 well. And so there's I think it's important to encourage, like, young faculty to, you know, there's summer seminar, like Calvin College has wonderful, you know, summer seminars in different disciplines with leading scholars from all over the world. People spend a month studying how Christianity relates to their discipline with other people who are excited about that. Those are the kinds of resources that need to be built up, and the ones that are around need to be encouraged. That's often what they are afraid of. Even though they'll say, I have to lay low until I get tenure. But I know of cases, you know, of counterexamples to that, of people who are open about their Christianity and have gotten tenure at good places. But that's certainly the factor. I mean, to get a job, you know, they don't want someone, they don't want, you know, the job market's so competitive, they don't want to have something that's going to scare off the hiring committee and tenure is the same way. Yeah. And how do you see the connection between the religious and the... Not really, no. But you have. Yeah.
You described what you call a kind of renaissance in evangelical fellowship. Do you see the same thing happening in other quarters of Christendom, in Roman Catholicism, in Orthodoxy? Are they too having a kind of scholarly renaissance? And if so, what kind of dialogue is there among the branches of Christianity and scholarship? What could there be?
Yes. What I just recalled, I was supposed to be repeating the questions. That's probably the only one that you heard already. But what is there interfaith dialogue among Catholic, Orthodox? I don't know about Orthodox. I do know about Catholics because I was at Notre Dame for 16 years, and Notre Dame is a pretty good synergy between the serious Catholic scholars and the serious Protestant scholars. But I'd say the evangelical, you know, the Protestant scholars really are, you know, there's a larger percentage who are really thinking about relating faith and scholarship. And there's a lot of Catholic scholars who may be serious Catholics but don't think a whole lot about how it relates to the scholarship, partly in reaction to there's still some reaction to the sort of the heavy-handedness of the old Neo-Thomist kind of way of doing it. And then when that fell apart, there hasn't been a good sort of theoretical development of what should Catholic scholarship be, except among very conservative Catholics are the ones that are strongest in scholarship. But there is a pretty good relationship between conservative Protestants and conservative Catholic scholars, I think. But I think my view is I think the conservative Protestants have thought about integration of faith and learning a lot more than the Catholics have. Yeah.
Is this sort of a popular wag that's like 40 years behind, you know, or something something, is it going to take another 30 years for that? Or where does that fit into?
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I think Eagleton's probably right that these books have come out being such strident defenses of naturalism because they sense, it's like fundamentalists, that they sense, you know, the world is turned away from the obvious truths, and so you really need to defend it. I don't know what the reception would be or the reception among young people. I mean, Christian Smith talks about the younger generation as simply being indifferent to religious issues. And I would think, you know, I mean, it might be people that are serious enough, people who are brought up in more conservative evangelical homes, then they are a constituency that might be might take these issues seriously enough to read those books, but that's probably pretty unusual, I would imagine. But, yeah.
Since we agree that methodological naturalism is a pretty good way of doing our academic work, but that privatization is a very bad way of living our faith, how does the Christian scholar integrate their faith with their academic work? Since the academic standard is to keep it out as a method, but the theology and scripture say faith has to be part of everything we do.
Yes. I do talk about that in The Outrageous Idea of Christian Scholarship, because it's a very good question. It's one that I've thought a lot about. And basically, one does one's science or the naturalistic part of, let's say, history. One determines what are the facts of the matter, pretty much the same way all historians have certain standards of doing good history and looking at the evidence, having good arguments, and the like. But that methodological naturalism takes place within the framework of ideological commitments. And often people aren't, they don't analyze their own commitments so much, but in any case, what one needs to be doing is to be thinking hard about how those ideological commitments refract the scientific work that you're doing, and they change it. In a number of ways, and one is, what questions do you ask about your material? And if you're a Christian writing about Civil War, I have a friend who Skip Stout at Yale wrote a book on a moral history of the Civil War. He asked some questions about the Civil War that grew out of his Christian commitment. Was the Civil War a just war? But his scientific part of his history is just the same as anybody else's, but the questions that he's asking are shaped by his religious commitment. And what I'm saying is, people need to be thinking about how those commitments shape their other work. And my example is, 50 years ago, gender made a lot of difference in the way people did their scholarship, but there weren't a lot of people thinking hard about what difference gender made in their scholarship. And since then, there's been a lot of hard thinking about that and a lot of interesting scholarship developing out of that. Well, the same applies to religious faith. There's a lot of these scholars around, the scholars that may be kind of privately Christian, and their Christianity has some influence on their scholarship, but they're not thinking hard about what that influence would be. And it seems to me that's the thing to be encouraging, is a consciousness raising about the importance of, you know, look, you have your faith here. It has to make a difference, just as social location makes a difference in scholarship, or gender makes a difference, whatever. What difference does it make? That's an important kind of thing to move out of the sort of the subconscious up to the conscious level.
Thank Dr. Marsden for that.